This is the podcast of the German Historical Institute London, a research centre dedicated to supporting and connecting students and scholars from Britain and Germany. The podcast series presents current research in British, German and European history, as well as colonial and global history. For more information on the German Historical Institute London, future events, the GHIL Library, studentships and more podcast episodes, please visit our website at ghil.ac.uk.
This podcast episode is a recording of a GHIL lecture by Benno Gammel, Professor of History of Gender and Sexuality at the European University Institute in Florence, on Queering German History, Still a Vital and Viable Endeavor? What difference can queer perspectives make in our understanding of the German past and in present-day conversations around sexual and gender diversity? Having taught and published on LGBT history for several years in Berlin, London, and other places, Benno Gammel takes this opportunity to reflect on the impact of such work, looking at experiences and struggles of same-sex loving and gender non-conforming people in Germany since around 1900, the talk discusses whether we should continue doing queer history in spite of the criticism that it essentializes sexual identity categories and against powerful pushback hailing from East and West, right-wing and other parts of the political spectrum.
Thank you very much for that very generous introduction. And I also obviously recommend reading all those books. If you read German, you can also read the queer books. And what I will present today is partly also based on the kind of more popular nonfiction historical book Queer, which I specifically wrote actually to reach out to a broader audience. But it, well, has not yet been translated. So kind of, you know, you've now get the chance to kind of listen to bits of it. Also, thanks to all and everybody else involved in preparing this. It's great to be back in a different surrounding, but I have very fond memories of my several times I had the pleasure to stay at the German Historical Institute. And I really have to say, also coming from kind of a European university, it's good to have those places where these kind of, you know, movements can come together, people can meet one another. That's not a given in the contemporary situation. So I think it's really a treasure that we can only hope to indulge in for the future as well. I am, nevertheless, coming from a totally scattered weekend, and that's primarily to do with personal reasons, and I don't want to bother you with those here. But the first blow for our weekend plans came when the La Fenice, the opera house in Venice, cancelled their opening performance of Wozzeck, which was scheduled for Friday. I don't know whether any of you have heard about that. The orchestra had decided to go on strike, and I do go in present-day culture wars, and that's kind of a first example. Why did they go on strike? They are protesting the nomination of Beatrice Venezzi as the new conductor from autumn 2026. That's when she's supposed to come into office, because the orchestra says that Venezzi lacks the necessary skills for the job and was only appointed due to her close ties with the far-right government of Italy. And I'm mentioning this here, it could have been in the Italian press, that was, you know, kind of, you cancel a premiere night. That is in Nietzsche, right? I mean, how can it go more prominent? You might have heard about a couple of other decisions about directors of cinema festivals, of other cultural events and programs, where in Italy, as elsewhere, we can observe that there is kind of a, you know, pretty strategic attempt at kind of changing the cultural landscape. And this is one example of that. There is no obvious queer connection here, at least I would not know, nor would I care to know. But there are still two reasons for prefacing my talk about whether queering German history is still a vital and viable endeavor with this story. First reason, as I said, it's an example of the fierce political conflicts we currently witness, also in cultural and academic arenas. And La Fenice, they fight a cultural war in the precise sense of the term right now. And it's still an open question whether kind of Beatrice Venezzi will actually come and take her position at the opera house. And I will return to the present day struggles also towards the end of my talk. But the second reason I started with this story is that the opera that was not performed on Friday is Alban Berg's Wozzeck. Based on Georg Büchner's radical theater play written in the 1830s, posthumously published four decades later, Alban Berg's WhatsApp premiered in 1925 at State Opera in Berlin. And it's actually kind of for that reason. You can now see it in various places because it's the 100th anniversary. And this kind of story pays you to through some of the steps and the time periods I will walk you through in my talk today. So the 19th century, the 1920s, when the opera premiered, and then I will also talk about the 1950s and the years around 1989. But there's also another reason why I thought it's interesting to start with WhatsApp, because the plot revolves around, among other things, I don't know, it is familiar with, if you're into German literature, you might have heard of the play. It revolves, among other things, around illicit sexuality, a child born out of wedlock, toxic masculinity, and a femicide. And these are not, I would say, not your usual suspects when you think about queer history. But maybe it makes sense to broaden our understanding of what the project of queering German history may entail. And in according to such a broadened understanding, these topics would be kind of perfectly fall within the purview of queer history. To give it away right now, I will argue that to remain vital and viable, queer history needs to embrace such themes, toxic masculinity, femicide, violence against women, children born out of wedlock, illicit sexuality in all its forms and shapes, needs to embrace these topics that may at first glance seem to be utterly heterosexual, especially in the WhatsApp version. And in this respect, kind of asking for a broadening of queer history, my contribution is resonating with Jennifer Evans's The Queer Art of History, Queer Kinship After Fascism, where she writes, quote, "Instead of a siloed history of the LGBTQIA quest for recognition, or one organized around collectivities of the same, what happens if we stress overlap and interconnectedness amid the disjunct simultaneity of experiences of oppression?" The disjunct simultaneity of experiences of oppression, end quote. Following this line of thought, I think we can also make queer history more broadly relevant for German history at large. At least I hope to show that that may be the case. So that's kind of what I plan to do. And as expert listeners to academic talks, you may now begin to wonder, what does he mean when he talks about queer? I use the term, this is going to be very brief, but we can come back to it in the Q&A, of course. I use the term in a twofold sense. It is firstly an umbrella term for the different shades of the LGBT plus spectrum, and it refers secondly, and there may be a certain tension here, to a theoretical approach, queer theory, that criticizes the neat compartmentalization of identities and challenges cis-heteronormative power structures. That's kind of what I mean when I say queer. And the verb queering indicates that this challenging is an open-ended process that one needs to actively engage in time and again. And this is kind of the more concrete steps I will walk you through this afternoon and evening. I'll briefly talk about Imperial Germany as maybe a most progressive place, about Weimar Germany and the variety of struggles that took place there, about post-war Germany, which we may consider it as queer as thought, and Wende Germany, so the years around 1989-1990, unsettling East-West dichotomies, and then I will kind of conclude with some remark about how we could comprehend the past and the present from a queer point of view. So, talking about Imperial Germany, I think one can well see what difference queer perspectives make in our understanding of the German past, especially looking at Imperial times or Wilhelmine Germany. Between 1871 and 1918, German society was not only characterized by militarism, colonial wars, and the exploitation of workers. I think this is still kind of a perception that is widespread. I mean, historians know better, but kind of in public perception, this is still kind of militarism, colonial wars, exploitation of workers, and this kind of the iron of German Empire. But it is also a time of democratic beginnings, aesthetic avant-garde, and mass media excitement. Alongside beer and bockwurst-fueled celebrations of Sedan Day and the Kaiser's birthday, there were social democratic protests, life reform experiments, women's protests, and struggles for homosexual emancipation. Doctors and psychiatrists sought understanding for same-sex lovers and gender non-conforming people. Women's associations argued about abortion, and the protection of unmarried mothers. Else Lasker Schüler provoked with her scandalous eroticized performances. The social democrat August Bebel criticized bourgeois marriage based on property, and others enthusiastically embraced nude hiking or designed corset-free reform dresses. And I think it's important to kind of keep all of that in view when we think and talk about Imperial Germany. In the 1860s, German courts upheld Karl Heinrich Ulrich's right to publish books that argued against societal prejudice against same-sex desire. Karl Heinrich Ulrich kind of sometimes described as the first homosexual rights activist. And there was an explicit kind of court decision against censorship against his publications. In 1896, Havelock Ellis's Sexual Inversion appeared first in German, as it was easier to publish on such topics in a German context than it was in the UK. A book appeared, kind of famous foundational work on thinking around same-sex desire, appeared 1 year later in the UK. So again, something that might change our perspective on Imperial Germany. This kind of openness towards the acceptance of sexual diversity in a German context, relative, of course, I should add, was also due to the activities of the first homosexual emancipation movement that formed in Germany around that time. Adolf Brandt began publishing the world's first homosexual magazine, Die Eigenen, in 1896, and Magnus Hirschfeld and others founded the Scientific Humanitarian Committee in 1897. And this is the memorial for this first homosexual emancipation movement in Berlin, which was also shown on the invite for this event. If you ever come to Berlin and look for it, it's along on the shores of the River Spree, just opposite the House of World Cultures, where the Institute for Sexual Science, founded by Magnus Hirschfeld in 1919, also used to be. It's not there anymore. It's also called the Magnus Hirschfeld Uther. And there is this this monument for the first homosexual emancipation movement dedicated to the work of these early activists. How widely discussions around homosexuality resonated with the German public in imperial times can also be seen from the Harden-Eulenburg affair that began to unfold in 1906 when journalist Maximilian Harden exposed the same-sex inclinations of Philipp Prinz Eulenburg, a close confidant, a friend as well of William II, the then emperor of Germany. And I mean, this is one of the points where kind of the impact on German history becomes most direct, right? Because that had kind of implications for foreign policy as well, also for the position of the emperor within the political system, and led kind of to a change of the advisors around the emperor, and arguably to a change from a more France-friendly to kind of a more nationalistic position. But basically, so it was kind of a close friend of William II who was accused of engaging in homosexual acts. And there was a series of court cases in which also Magnus Hirschfeld was testifying as a medical expert. And these were widely covered in the press. So it's really kind of, it was the talk of the town. And what I bring you here refers to one special aspect of that series of court cases. In 1908, the scene of judicial action shifted from Berlin to Munich. In a courtroom there, the Fischerjacke, Fisherman John Jacob, I don't know, one of his friends from the Starnberger See in Bavaria testified that they had had sex with Prince Eulenburg in the early 1880s. And this is a sketch from the Social Democratic, der wahre Jakob, from August 1908, which refers exactly to this kind of scene. So it's, or to this aspect, it's, I don't know whether you can really prominently in the surface here, you see one of your Adam, and on the left hand side, it goes to Paradise, and on the right hand side to Lake Starnberg, Starnberger See, where a buff Bavarian bloke is tempting the modern Adam. And now, I mean, you can already see what decision he takes. But I mean, just as an example of, you know, how popular these discussions also were in the early 20th century. All this shows how colorful, in parts also how progressive a place Imperial Germany was. And why do I think all this is most important? It hints at a question with which one can counter present-day far-right critics of today's complexity in terms of gender and sexuality. Often you find, you know, kind of, in the old days, things were easier, and now kind of everybody is suddenly coming up with this and that and further aspects of diversity in terms of gender and sexuality. So there is this longing for a past when it was supposedly easier, especially for a white middle-class man, to navigate the terrain of sex and gender. But what you can see here is, at least we can ask the question, has that allegedly more simple past actually ever happened? And looking at Imperial Germany, I think the answer is quite clearly no. Let's move one step further to Weimar Germany. Moving on to the 1920s, I want to highlight two aspects in particular. How the struggle for the rights of same-sex desiring people was linked to other causes, and how there was also tensions within the queer spectrum. This is why I'm talking here about the variety of struggles. Here you see a publication on the World League for Sexual Reform, more specifically on their 1928 Congress in Copenhagen, when they officially endorsed the 10-point agenda. And before that meeting, after the meeting in Copenhagen was the conference in London in 1929, but the first meeting was in Berlin, you know, very much kind of also inspired by, again, Magnus Hirschfeld.
Next to Ufisbore and Hamad Ali, who's already been mentioned, Laura Russell
and Norman Hare in the bottom of the page, you know, as kind of presidents and secretaries of the World League for Sexual Reform, an international organization. What I want to point out is the program that they kind of agreed, the agenda they pushed for, which included the equality of men and women in sexual, political, and economic terms, access to contraception and birth control, eugenicist selection, also in terms of sterilization, decriminalization of consensual same-sex encounters, non-discrimination of unmarried mothers and children born out of wedlock, and broad sex education and enlightenment for the population. So here you can see that the homosexual rights agenda, at least in this context, was really connected with a broad variety of topics and struggles combined with other issues. Some of them, like the eugenicist aspects, deeply problematic. Others closely connected to feminist and working class concerns. If you think of illegitimate children, illegitimate in inverted commas, and access to birth control. Establishing such alliances across homosexual rights movement, feminist movement, working class concerns, establishing such alliances across different movements and struggles was a strategy pursued in particular by the more left-leaning part of the homosexual emancipation movement. And within Weimar Germany, this was most prominently represented by Magnus Hirschfeld, who was also a member of the Social Democratic Party. Other parts of the movement were less inclusive and broad in their agendas. When it came to the almost successful attempt to decriminalize consensual sex between adult males in 1929, so that was in one of the Reichstag committees, and it did not, it almost got through, but not really in the end. But what is interesting is where the negotiations. So the left-leaning part of the homosexual rights movement tried to push for various agendas, including also the interests of mostly working class hustlers and kind of young blokes being accused of kind of blackmailing respectable homosexual men. Whereas center-right advocates of the homosexual cause were happy to throw working class hustler and other less respectable parts of the queer spectrum under the bus to gain benefits for themselves from the state. So these were exactly the discussions that were going on there. And there you can see that there was kind of conflicting interests also within the queer spectrum. And this is one of the reasons that the reform never happened, decriminalization never happened, not in the late 1920s. The other reason, of course, that parliament was dissolved and we entered then the place of political instability. Similar closeness and tensions between different groups and different interests within the queer spectrum can also be observed between different parts of what we would describe as trans community today. Here we see Yusi, Toni Ebel, Charlotte Schalack, and Dora Richter, who underwent different gender-affirming procedures in the 1920s and 1930s in the context of the Institute for Sexual Science in Berlin and its surroundings. Whether people should undergo surgical interventions or limit themselves to cross-dressing, so kind of not changing the body, but kind of just changing the dress, was one of the bones of contestation in Weimar times. So kind of people who underwent surgical interventions were sometimes described as extreme transvestites, and some people argued kind of this is taking things too far. Another tension and conflict concerned the rift between respectable middle-class family men who once in a while wore a dress and the notorious demi-monde of female impersonators working in nightclubs. So kind of there was a group of self-described transvestites who would emphasize that they are kind of absolutely, you know, normal living conditions, wife, kids. But, you know, every second week, I like to go out in female attire. And they distanced themselves pretty clearly from kind of less respectable parts of the trans spectrum, especially also from same-sex desiring trans men and women, right? They said, we've nothing to do with homosexuality. We have nothing to do with those people who hang around bars and kind of dance on the stage in some semi-naked female attire. We are the respectable transvestites. Especially when it came to safeguards against persecution. And the most important safeguard against police persecution at the time was the so-called Transvestitenscheine that allowed their bearers to wear the attire of the opposite sex in public. But especially when it came to such forms of state recognition and kind of protection against persecution, some trans people were not disinclined to discredit others whom they deemed less worthy of such state-sponsored recognition and protection. So again, here you have these conflicts. Alliances between different groups who did not conform to cis-heterosexist expectations were not always a matter of course within queer history. So looking at the Weimar period, we can see how the struggle for the rights of same-sex desiring and gender non-conforming people was, on the one hand, linked to feminist, socialist, and other causes, and how, on the other hand, quarrels arose within the queer spectrum when some groups tried to put themselves in a privileged position vis-a-vis others. The next part looks into 1950s West Germany. And this is not because I think that the Nazi period is less relevant. In fact, there will be references to Nazi persecution later on. But I want to emphasize the 1950s because they are often represent kind of the good old times I've already talked about, right? A lot of people, when they think about like before it all happened, before things came complicated, then they think of the 1950s, especially present day critics of gender and sexual diversity who imagine the good old times would have been like the 1950s. Which brings me to the question, how non-queer were the 1950s, in fact? This is a film still from a TV production from 2011. Schicksalsjahre, Fateful Years. I always have to think of Schicksalsjahre and like Kaiserin, which is the third. Anyway, Schicksalsjahre is the title of the book. It's based on a book by Uwe Carsten Heyer, who some of you might remember, know. He was the speaker of Gerhard Schröder's government, also a journalist, and wrote this autobiographical book called From Glück nur ein Schatten, Only a Shade of Happiness, which is especially about his childhood. And this is kind of the story. So his mother believed that the father had died in the war. And after the war ended, they struggled to survive in the late 1940s and 1950s Germany. And then she meets this other woman and they kind of are family together, right? I mean, it's difficult because kind of they stage look quite nicely. So you think like, you know, that's not our times. But if you look at it, I mean, two women maybe looking for an apartment, two kids in the background, seems to be like a rainbow family situation. But the film itself, so the book is from, just to give you that date as well, the book is from 2004 and the film is from 2011. The film itself does a lot to preempt such a queer reading of the scene, to preempt that kind of rainbow family understanding of what's going on here, and very much focuses on the love between Ursula, the woman on the left, and her husband, who she believes to have died in the war, but then he comes back and, you know, you have that kind of happy end. But the love relationship between Ursula and Nora on the right here is also part of the story. So it's, at least it's there in that classical 1950s setting. And why I'm saying all this, first of all, because there is something that Christine already mentioned. You find that described in more detail by Elena Maria Mayeres and Katja Patzel-Matern in the third volume of our handbook, Queer Contemporary Histories, which is in German, but it's free and online. So at least one advantage. And why is it really interesting? Because kind of, I think here you really, it's about how you look at it, right? We think of the 1950s as this kind of very heteronormative time period. But, I mean, two women forming a household together with or without kids, without the presence of a man, was not a rare occurrence in the 1950s after the Second World War and after so many men had died or did not come back or for whatever other reason. So if you look at it from this point of view, you know, heteronormative families maybe were less widespread in the 1950s than one might think. And if we broaden our understanding of queer history, we can bring such phenomena into view without prematurely ascribing same-sex desires or lesbian identities to the women who lived with and cared for one another in such kinship formats. So we don't need to necessarily decide what exactly do we see here, but it kind of can get us thinking about how heteronormative were those times actually. And I can't resist it. This perspective on female-female-led households and families as a kind of a non-rare phenomenon in the 1950s can actually also shed fresh light on the 1957 Constitutional Court decision for the Nazi version of paragraph 175. Okay, now I want to explain a little bit. 175, probably most of you know, is the paragraph in the German Penal Code that punished sexual acts between men. And the Nazis kind of radicalized that paragraph in 1935. And in West Germany, that was in force, the Nazi version, till 1969. The paragraph was challenged in front of the Federal Constitutional Court in West Germany in the 1950s on the grounds that it violated the constitutional principle of equal treatment of men and women. Why? Because the paragraph only punished male homosexuality, not female homosexuality. The court decided in 1957 that the paragraph could continue to be in force and that it did not violate the principle of equal treatment because, well, basically females were considered as non-sexual beings. So intimacy between women was considered as be less dangerous, less of a social problem that the law needed to intervene into. But if you look at this, you can also turn things around and wonder what would have happened if female homosexuality would have been turned into a punishable offense in the 1950s. What would have happened if two women cohabitating would have been a trigger for a police investigation? We lack precise numbers because also statistically, kind of these households and families were invisibilized, right? These women would always be counted in statistics we have as single women. But there were such families and households. And I mean, you know, if turning that into a reason for a police investigation could well have undermined the living arrangements of a fair share of the population in 1950s West Germany. So such perspectives may help to dismantle the still prevalent image of the 1950s as a time of blissful heteronormativity that was not the least shaped by the Heimatfilme produced in the period. And if you were me, you would have very vivid memories of those films because you could permanently see them on television still in the 1980s. Now, not that much anymore, I hope. Anyway, so much about the 1950s. And we move on to Germany in the Wende years and to unsettling East-West dichotomies. What difference can queer perspectives make in our understanding East and West German history differently? In establishing rules for gender-affirmative interventions and in decriminalizing consensual sex between adults, the GDR was ahead of the FRG, the Federal Republic of Germany. So, I mean, East Germany regulations for gender-affirmative procedures were established in 1976. In West Germany, that was the case 4 years later in 1980. And decriminalization was decided in 1988. In East Germany came into force in 1989, and in West Germany, actually as an effect of harmonizing penal codes of the East German and the West German penal code, in 1994, paragraph 175 was finally abolished from the German penal code for the West German context. So, you know, kind of we tend to think of West Germany being ahead and East Germany catching up. In this context, it's sort of the other way around. But the point is not to turn widely held assumptions about Western liberality and Eastern repression around and to claim that the GDR was more liberal than the Federal Republic in sexual and gender matters. The point is rather to challenge what we think we know about both societies in the 1980s and up. Here you see the lesbische Gedenkkugel, the lesbian commemorative globe that was after long and hard-fought struggles, finally installed on the Ravensbrück concentration camp memorial site in 2022. Lesbian activists from East Berlin and other parts of the GDR, who formed groups within the context of the Protestant Church in the 1980s, began working towards the public recognition of same-sex desiring women as victims of Nazi persecution as early as the mid-1980s. So, you know, more than 35 years until this finally came to fruition. Maria Bühner has published insightful work on this whole story. Her publications also show that queer activists formed actually an important part of the opposition against the SED regime, the East German regime. So it's one thing, there is activists who go to that concentration camp memorial site. I don't know whether anybody has ever been there in Ravensbrück. So that was part of kind of the non-GDR territory. And there, of course, the dominant narrative was Nazi persecution of communists. And they kind of time and again go there and try to make visible the persecution of same-sex desiring women. It's a concentration camp for women. This is why this is the important spot for the whole discussion. So this is something that happens already in the GDR. For those of you who are familiar with the history of the GDR in its last decade, this does not come as a surprise that one can observe various diversifying dynamics and that new opportunities for queer visibility arose within East German society long before the Wende of 1989-1990. But for those who are less familiar with this history, it might still deserve mentioning. At the same time, from a queer history point of view, it is also clear that there was no continuous process of liberalization and growing acceptance of sexual and gender diversity since 1945 in West Germany. So now I'm coming to the other side, right? In East Germany, we see there was activism, there were groups, there was kind of opposition, and that was actually kind of a part of the opposition movement in the East Germany. But if we look at West Germany, it's also not as clear-cut a liberalizing success story as we may think. Looking at the 1980s, AIDS re-intensified societal stigmatization, in particular for gay men, and trans people had to confront the human rights violations that the so-called Transsexuellengesetz of 1980 entailed. So there was the worst aspect of that law was that if you wanted to have gender affirmative care, you needed to agree to lose your reproductive abilities. This just to show you kind of how severe those human rights violations were. So there is also looking at West Germany, really harsh discriminations and forms of violence. There is also, I don't know how many remember Herbert Ruscha, the first openly gay member of the West German Bundestag, who sat for the Green Party since 1983. And I bring him up here because he was shot by a neo-Nazi at a panel discussion in Munich in 1984 and was not too seriously injured. So if you see him here back at the speaker's desk in 1985, but this assault is interesting, right? So Munich, 1984, neo-Nazi goes, shoots a gay politician who was struggling for decriminalization and other homosexual rights causes. And this assault, I think, is interesting because it warns us against the assumption that far-right attacks against queer people were something that sort of came out of the blue over the last couple of years. Now, here you see also in West Germany, there's a long continuity of right-wing violence against queer people. And this is just one example. There is a long continuity of anti-queer and other forms of far-right violence also in West Germany. Queer history is thus a good starting point for disassembling some of the still far too firmly established preconceptions about East and West. And with that, I come to my concluding remarks about comprehending past and present from a queer point of view. I think queering remains a vital endeavor because it enables us to better understand the complexity of German history. And it allows us to shed a fresh light on current situations. And now I come also back to the question of what do we do with all this today? This is one of my mantras. The queer past and present are shaped by a contradictive simultaneity of stigma, emancipation, and normality. Queer people were continuously faced with stigmatization and violence. And they time and again formed movements to counter this discrimination and to fight for society's emancipation from cis-heteronormative prejudices and hierarchies, as I've shown in the different steps of my talk. At the same time, we can also observe how parts of what had previously been considered perverse and unacceptable became, for more and more people, a normal part of an expanding spectrum of sexual and gender possibilities. This is the normality or normalization bit. So what once was unacceptable becomes to be considered normal. Some queer historians emphasize the problematic aspects of these dynamics. They can entail, as we have seen, that certain more respectable parts of the queer spectrum improve their position at the expense of other groups. We've seen that looking into kind of trans tensions within the trans community in Weimar Germany, for example. And normalization arguably lures queer movements into forgetting about the more radical, more comprehensive agendas that link their struggles with those of other groups fighting against oppression. Kind of these links, kind of I discussed them when we talked about the World League for Sexual Reform, but you can also think of the 1970s gay and lesbian feminist movements, where arguably there was kind of a larger attention, broader attention to linking one's own kind of homosexual cause to broader question of social and global injustice. This view that normalization lures queer movements into forgetting about those broader agendas can nurture a sense of loss and sponsor a queer history narrative that gives prominence to the anti-capitalist and anti-patriarchal activism of the 1970s that later on allegedly gave way to a civil rights-based LGBT movement that focused on single issues like gay marriage and on queer individuals' right to live a normal life just like everybody else. And Herbert Rusche can almost be considered as being exactly at that passage point, right? Where these larger ideas from the 1970s begin to feed into official politics and then much later translate into legislation like same-sex marriage and kind of legislation for the adoption of children and the establishment of rainbow families. And I think this is also a narrative you can find in other contexts. That's why I think it's helpful to point it out once more that there was this radicality of the 1970s, and then there is kind of a describe it as a normalization process of the 1980s and 1990s, and we end up with kind of almost like a depoliticized political landscape. Broader social justice agendas were increasingly sidelined. This situation, so one could continue the argument, makes it now very difficult for queer people to forge alliances against and to forcefully counter the re-intensification of homo and trans hostile attitudes and the increasing levels of anti-queer violence, right? So that impetus of broad political resistance and alliance building has somehow been lost. Whether this is a fair and helpful assessment of queer German history over the last 50 years, this is one of the most crucial debates within the field at the moment. I think it is not helpful and therefore emphasizes the simultaneity of stigma, emancipation, and normality. So I would say it's not that kind of first you have a broad sense of emancipation, then you have the normalization process, and then you end up with an inability to counter a re-intensified violence and anti-queer societal attitudes. I think it's much more important to think about these different aspects. Stigmatization, emancipation, normalization as happening at the same time and think through them in their contradictive simultaneity. This emphasis on the simultaneity of stigma, emancipation, and normality also broadens the horizon of queer history. By keeping in view the different situations within which same-sex desiring and gender non-conforming people lived at the same time, some suffered, some fought courageously, some enjoyed newly won opportunities. And I think that this allows for a helpfully balanced view. Whether normalization is good or bad is not necessarily the best question for historians. It might be better to observe normalizing dynamics, ask what their effects were, and how they affected different groups within the queer spectrum and beyond in specific ways. And some of that I have tried to do during the talk. And then also to ask what other contradicting dynamics occurred at the same time. For example, what about queer people who were just beginning to enjoy the privilege of normality when they were faced with the loss of income and socioeconomic status? And if you think about the 1980s and 1990s, this is not kind of an unlikely situation. Or those who fell in love with a racialized person and realized that their main problem was no longer their queer hostile, but their racist environment. By asking such questions, a broadened queer history would remain open to solidarities between different struggles for social justice. It would also attend to intersectional perspectives to how struggles against racism, classism, cis-heteronormativity, and so on were and are interlocked, how different social hierarchies co-shaped, attenuated, or intensified one another. Quote, "There is no such thing as a single-issue struggle because we do not live single-issue lives." A quote from Audre Lorde, and she said that in a 1982 speech paying tribute to Malcolm X. In the 1980s and 1990s, Lorde lived in Berlin for several years, and this is one of the reasons why recently a street was renamed in Berlin-Kreuzberg. Here you see how the arch-conservative Otto Theodor von Manteuffel, Prime Minister of Prussia from 1850 to 1858, had to make way for the self-described black lesbian mother warrior poet Audre Lorde in the renaming of a street in Berlin. And here you also see, I'm bringing this because Lorde is so famous and important for exactly promoting this, what I call an intersectional perspective, where different struggles against oppression are always thought as interlocked with one another, linked to one another. And kind of, I think the difference to Manteuffel couldn't be more pronounced on all levels. The queering of German history that transpires from such commemorative efforts remains, now I say yes, a vital and viable endeavor. But I think it needs to be a very specific understanding of queer historical practice to keep it vital and viable. Because, in conclusion, some of you may wonder about the still in my title. Still a vital and viable endeavor. And some may wonder, is queer history not kind of a fairly new field? Why should one bother to abandon it practically while it only begins to gain traction? If you're familiar with the field, you would not ask that question because that's what people discuss, right? Can we still do queer history? I formulated the title question in light of criticisms that blame queer history for essentializing sexual identity categories, and that argue that it is queer history is inextricably linked to an understanding of queerness that has a white middle class bias. And from most of the things I showed to you, you can actually see that white middle class bias. It's also for these reasons that I have argued for a broadened perspective, one that does not restrict itself to queer phenomena in a narrow sense of the term, one that is aware of the various injustices people are faced with and fight against at the same time, and one that is particularly attentive to racist, classist, ableist, ageist, and other forms of discrimination within the queer spectrum itself. So one that is self-critical, the essential point. Should one, after all that broadening and stretching, still call it queer history? Why not trans history, feminist history, intersectional history, or simply history? These questions concern tricky issues of visibility, of which aspect is named and given prominence, and also of what is no longer deemed acceptable by certain funding authorities. And I'm saying this being fully aware that some colleagues, when formulating applications for funding, think about kind of how much they should tone down the feminist, queer, trans perspectives that motivate their research in order to make sure that they win the grant. And this is not just in the United States, this is also in Europe, right? And I think also for this reason, it remains important to put the label there. One more quote from Jen Evans's The Art of Queer History. "We weather new culture wars that use history as a tool of organized forgetting, separating us from the struggles waged by queer and trans people and their allies for a more just world." And this is kind of, I think, something, maybe the main reason why it remains vital to do queer history. It remains vital to continue critiquing cis-heteronormative power structures in the past and in the present, and to do so under a label that clearly signals this endeavor. The powerful pushback from right-wing and other parts of the political spectrum in East and West is also the reason why there is no time to wait until the field of queer history is more fully established. Actually, kind of the Center for Queer History that you've mentioned, unfortunately, ceased existing 2 years ago, right? So kind of, you know, we're not in a situation where we can wait and see and do the proper research, and then we have substantiated fundamental knowledge, then we can move on to the next stop. No, we need to do both things at the same time. We need to work towards the production of queer history knowledge, and at the same time critique its foundations and broadening its purview. We need to do all that at the same time. It is vital to show how people fought for a more just world in the past. It is vital to show that struggles around sexual and gender diversity are not a present-day fad, but have been waged for a long time. It is vital to show that there is no blissful past where matters of sex and desire were well ordered and could be navigated easily and without suffering by everybody. But there may well be a future where things are more just, also on the shifting terrain of gender and sexuality. Queering German History endeavors to prepare the grounds for it. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the German Historical Institute London podcast. Follow us on social media and check our website to keep up to date with new episodes.